Welcome to A Global Focus with guest Alfred Lavermont Weber, JD, MED, futurist, and author of Exopolitics, Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe. Welcome to A Global Focus with guest Alfred Lavermont Weber, JD, MED, futurist, and author of Exopolitics, Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe. Welcome, everyone. This is Dree Sheridan, host of A Global Focus with website at aglobalfocus.com. Alfred Lavermont Weber is our guest this evening. A Global Focus broadcast live on the International Paranormal Radio Network with anchor station UPRN 105.7 FM New Orleans. Check the UFOParanormalRadio.com page for the several additional listening venues. Thanks to Joe Montaldo for making these broadcasts possible. Alfred Lavermont Weber, JD, MD, MED, is a futurist and author of Exopolitics, Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe, which book is available at www.universebooks.com. With his Exopolitics book, Alfred founded the field of Exopolitics, the science of relations among intelligent civilizations in the multiverse. Now, Alfred Lavermont Weber, JD and MED's upcoming book is Dimensions, the Dimensional Ecology of the Multiverse. Alfred also is a journalist whose Examiner.com articles are widely read in North America. Alfred is the founder of www.exopolitics.com, a leading exopolitical news website, and the host of Exopolitics TV. Alfred's investigative journalism has been featured on True TV, Examiner.com, Press TV, and mainstream TV networks. For the latest updates on Alfred's research and articles, visit www.exopolitics.com. Alfred is chairman of the Mars Anomaly Research Society, or MARS, at www.projectmars.net. Mars Anomaly Research Society is spearheading the international effort to research, disclose, and educate the public about life on Mars. Also, Alfred has proposed a truth amnesty process to facilitate the release of the advanced extraterrestrial-derived new energy that can be used to sustain a peaceful space-age society. Alfred is a graduate of Yale University and Yale Law School in International Law, and was a Fulbright Scholar in International Economic Integration in Uruguay. Alfred has taught economics at Yale University and constitutional law at the University of Texas. Alfred was general counsel to the New York City Environmental Protection Administration, a futurist at Stanford Research Institute, where he directed the proposed 1977 Carter White House Extraterrestrial Communication Study, and was an NGO delegate to the United Nations and the Unispace Conference. Alfred is currently developing Exo University, an educational entity with website at www.exouniversity.org. Exo University's goal is to provide web-based, interactive, continuing education, research, information, and policy regarding exopolitics, psi sciences, and exosciences to and institutions throughout the world. Alfred's website is www.exopolitics.com. Boy, that's impressive. And Alfred, welcome. I'm thrilled to have your guest this evening. Well, you know, Alfred, I have several questions about your Exopolitics book.
Sure. You know, Trice?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to jump in and
absolutely
just make a brief update.
Absolutely.
Very, very lengthy bio. But you wouldn't have known this because the changes just went up on the bio on my website last night. And it was something that I myself was just informed of, peremptorily noticed by Examiner.com on December 6th, and that is that they canceled my column on the fraudulent ground that I was publishing false information. Well, this, I have published a public notice stating that in no uncertain terms, I do not publish false information, that their action was taken while I was on a two-week trip, and immediately after I was a judge on the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal, where we found former U.S. President and former U.K. Prime Minister Tony Blair and U.S. President George W. Bush guilty of crimes against peace, which are the most serious of war crimes. And the owner of Examiner.com, who has been voted the greediest billionaire, is a very close friend of George W. Bush. And as well, this happened immediately after I published an article with multiple whistleblowers who placed U.S. President Barack Obama, then known as Barry Satoro, in the secret CIA Mars visitation program from 1980 to 1983, where he took a secret Mars training and was up on Mars numerous times, along with over 100,000 Americans. So this is an embarrassment to the current administration, which just two or three weeks ago issued a notice that stated in response to the extraterrestrial disclosure petition that in fact there's no proof that there are other intelligences, whereas he was tasked during his days at the CIA Mars visitation program with learning the Martian language and with completing a three-month threat assessment of the Martian civilization toward the civilization, which he completed with two other members of his training. One is Regina Dugan, who he appointed the current director of DARPA, and the other is Andrew D. Bishago, who was a childhood participant in DARPA's Project Pegasus and a member of that 1980 to 1983 Mars visitation program. So I just wanted to say that I'm not a journalist with Examiner, but I'm a widely read journalist with my articles at exopolitics.com. So thank you for letting me put in this clarification.
Well, Alfred, you have a brilliant mind, and you are known for speaking with great sincerity. So even if people would differ with your viewpoints, you certainly have a fine intellect, a great academic and career record, a sterling record as an attorney. And if you can differ with your opinions, so be it. This is a public forum, and I think this is going to be a great discussion.
Great.
Now, Alfred, if we could just bring some of the people here up to a date here. I first heard about the possibility of a Martian population. Am I remembering it correctly? In your exopolitics, politics, law, and government in the universe book, which is considered a treatise by many people in the field, do I remember this correctly, that there was a reference to a Martian catastrophe? And could you just give us information on this?
Yeah, sure. You know, your audio's breaking up a bit, so...
Oh, I'll speak right up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. I think I heard your question correctly, and that is to summarize what was stated about the Martian civilization in my exopolitics book. Is that correct?
Yes.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah. This was really before I had written essentially in the year 2000, and before I had had the opportunity to interview and interact with four independent eyewitnesses and whistleblowers from secret U.S. programs who have been to Mars and who have interacted with the Martians civilization. But back then, what I did was, because I had been a futurist at Stanford Research Institute in the mid-1970s. In fact, it was Dr. Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ, whom I first met at SRI, and they were the ones who suggested that I contact Peter Schwartz and others at the Futurist Institute, which I did, and that they offered me a position as a futurist. So I knew from reading the scientific literature then that remote viewing was a way to acquire real information about events, real non-local information. Events that are there, about events that are at some other timeline, and that this is that this methodology was being used for U.S. espionage, and I knew that because of my interactions with other futurists and with Russell Targ and Dr. Hal Puthoff at SRI in my reading of the literature. And so what occurred is that starting with the SRI and a bit before, the U.S. Department of Defense established remote viewing, which is a form of non-local perception according to a scientific protocol, and trained remote viewers. That was initiated for military intelligence application, generally espionage, or generally what I would call interpersonal harassment. Somewhere along the late 80s, people who were graduates of this program, or in fact, some within the U.S. military program, began to turn their attention to applying remote viewing to other celestial bodies to attempt to view or contact intelligent civilizational bodies in the multiverse or in other dimensions. And significant among these were Dr. Courtney Brown of the Farsight Institute in Atlanta, Georgia. And I contacted Dr. Courtney Brown, and he was kind enough to write an analysis and introduction to my book, Exopolitics. And so, in a way, exopolitics is the social science. It's the science of relations among intelligent civilizations in the multiverse. It's sort of like the anthropology of the multiverse, in the same way that anthropology looks at the different forms of humanity here on the planet. Exopolitics looks at the different typologies of intelligent civilizations and the relations among them. And one of the tools that is used, or that can be used, to acquire information about intelligent civilizations that are on another celestial body or in another dimension is, of course, remote viewing, that is, scientific remote viewing, according to strict protocols such as those developed for the U.S. Department of Defense. And Dr. Courtney Brown was one of the ones who applied this to for an exopolitical application with some rigor. And he was able to develop interactive communications with a number of entities that are off-planet, one of which was an apparent underground civilization, a human civilization, living under the surface of Mars. And there are various interactions that are described there in the remote viewing transcripts and the remote viewing interactions. Well, of course, this is one of the valid sources of data. Now, it's subject to external validation. So we were able to, as an early exopolitical exercise, to say, look, we have this preliminary data derived by remote viewing, and we know that remote viewing in a military intelligence context is extremely accurate as a methodology of espionage. And here we have this data that's been acquired with regard to identifying an intelligent civilization, human civilization, living under the surface of Mars. So let's go forward and let's take this as a working hypothesis that there is a civilization under the surface of Mars, and let's develop some public policy that would make sense in terms of what would be the conditions for between the human society on Earth and the human civilization on Mars in terms of integration or reintegration, because even then the remote viewing data picked up that the human civilization, that both our human civilizations on Mars and on Earth had been ruptured apart very traumatically by celestial events. Now, that's what I published back in with my book, Exopolitics. And in the years intervening from there, I've been able to go forward and develop that quite a bit by identifying and interacting with four independent whistleblowers, all of them eyewitnesses, and all of them members of top secret U.S. government programs on Mars. The first of them is U.S. serviceman Michael Wolf, who spent 20 years as a member of the security staff at the U.S. facility on Mars, and was teleported there because the main method of transportation to Mars, to the U.S. facilities on Mars, is not by a spaceship, it's via Tesla-based quantum access teleportation. And he spent 20 years there. He's written two, with the aid of his wife, has written two books on the subject, both of them. They're called The Mars Records, and both of those books are available for download for free at our website, exopolitics.com. He spent the 20 years there from 1976 to 1996. And once again, his service was hidden in what we call time loops, using quantum access time travel. When his 20 years were up, he was age regressed and time traveled back to the exact date when he left in 1976. And then he completed his normal military duty to 1982. So if you looked at his Pentagon paperwork, you wouldn't know that he spent 20 years on Mars. And it was only through his two books that were collaborated by one of his colleagues that wrote another book that these substances come out. And I like to say that all four of the Mars whistleblowers, their accounts are congruent, even though they're independent. The second whistleblower, of course, is Andrew Bishago, who was a childhood participant in Project Pegasus, which was a project of DARPA's and the CIA to develop Tesla-based teleportation and time travel between 1972. And in those years, Andrew, on behalf of DARPA, as a young child, because they used gifted psychic children to time travel to the past and to the future, Andrew, and you can go online to exopolitics.com to his websites, projectpegasus.net and projectmars.net, and listen to all the programs and read a very large number of papers and articles that substantiate this. He would regularly visit a DARPA forward time base in the year 2045 and bring back time scrolls or reports from the year 2045, which were prepared for the U.S. government in 1971, in which the future, in essence, would help the past successfully get to the future. And that's part of the reason why we're on a positive timeline now, despite the fact that people, you know, some vested interests want to say that, 2012 is coming and it's the end of the world and there are going to be all these collisions with comets and earth changes, and these are catastrophic memes that don't bear a relation to reality. They're just people's ideas. One of the reasons that I am what they call quantum entangled with this, oh, I know that this is partially true, is that I myself had an encounter with Project Pegasus in 1971. And that is that in 1971, I was general counsel of the Environmental Protection Administration of New York City. And at that time, I was in the newspapers a great deal. I was in the New York Post every week. I was a crusading environmental lawyer with a relatively large staff of environmental lawyers. And I was invited by this organization that styled itself the Delaware Valley Industrial Engineering Association. They asked me to give them a talk on the environment, which I thought was nothing out of the ordinary, but this man came and picked me up and took me on a very long car journey, almost down to Delaware or, you know, Washington, D.C., and I ended up in this office building, this very large room with about 50 people, all of them bureaucrats in suits or coats and ties or, you know, shirts and ties. And they didn't look like an environmental activist group, which they were rather looked like CIA agents, Department of Defense agents, and DARPA agents. And that's, in fact, what they were. And the reason why this occurred in 1971 is that we now know through multiple witnesses that the CIA, through DARPA's Project Pegasus, had gone forward in time and acquired Exopolitics after it had been published in 2005 and had written it in 1999, and time traveled it back to at least 1971, where it was seen by three separate witnesses. In 1971, they witnessed my book, Exopolitics. So it was in the possession of Project Pegasus at that time. And that's very important because the defense attaché to Project Pegasus was a member of the Richard Nixon cabinet named Donald H. Rumsfeld, who then would go on to be Secretary of Defense of George W. Bush on 9/11. So that the U.S. government and the CIA had my work in 2005, my exopolitics work and my exopolitics activism in their possession in 1971. And two things happened. Number one, I was asked to go to this meeting under false pretenses, which is really with about 50 CIA and DARPA and Department of Defense operatives and personnel. And as I remember, as I was speaking, I had what overcame me was the feeling of what we can call cognitive dissonance. You know, I wasn't talking to an audience that was there to listen about the environment. They were there to see what this fellow, who in the year 2011 would be, you know, talking about life on Mars, and who had found the field of exopolitics and what he was like and what he was like actually back in 1971 as an activist environmental lawyer. So I had my own interaction unknowingly, what they call unwittingly, quote end of quote, with Project Pegasus and CIA Department of Defense back in 1971. And I must admit that at that time, all of a sudden, I felt like I was a character in the movie Enemy of the State. That's a movie in which the protagonist is a young lawyer who suddenly has the NSA all over his back because he unwittingly is carrying around some kind of national secret. And so that's why I tend, among other things, to give credence, because I've actually experienced this and am quantum entangled as a corroborative of the existence of Project Pegasus. Well, the third eyewitness is William Brett Stillings, who was a co-participant with Andrew Meshago in the CIA Mars visitation programs in 1980 to 83. And this is where I believe that my publication of a seminal article around November 15th and 16th of 2011 has led to such a shakeup, both at the current White House and in the CIA and Intel world. And that is that we now have two independent eyewitnesses, Andrew DiBisciaga, who's an attorney at law in the state of Washington. There would be severe professional penalties for him to commit perjury because he's a member of the bar. I myself am a member of the bar of the District of Columbia. There would be penalties to me for going out and making false public statements, as you yourself know, Trice, as you are an attorney.
Yes.
What William Brett Stillings can testify, and Andrew Meshago does testify, and both of their accounts are corroborative, is that between 1980 and 1983, they were initially in a Mars training with Barry Satoro, who then became Barack Obama, changed his name, and Regina Dugan, who is the current head director of DARPA. And they were all 18-year-olds, but they had been chosen because they were outstanding young people who were going to have a brilliant future. And they were given the challenge of going up to Mars because they figured by going to Mars and handling that kind of stress of being on another planet, they would be able to handle the stress of any job that they were given here on Earth, including that of President of the United States and Director of DARPA. Here we now have, Mr. Meshago and Mr. Stillings give very, very lengthy accounts, very detailed accounts, and this has been on Coast to Coast, and you can go to projectpegasus.net to listen to that program. Very detailed accounts of greeting Mr. Obama on the surface of Mars and what he said and how he acted. And now there's further information that has come out that three of them, Mr. Obama, Regina Dugan, and Mr. Bisciago, were chosen to go on the special 3-month course to learn the Martian language. They were then given intercepted communications from the Martians, and they had to write each separate essays on whether they considered the Martian civilization to be a threat to the U.S., to the planet Earth or not. And Mr. Obama, Regina Dugan, and Mr. Bisciago completed their assessments. Andrew Bisciago relates how he talked shop with Regina Dugan, but Barack Obama, who was from a third generation family, that is, both his grandparents were CIA. His mother was CIA. We don't know who his father is. There's some people who've written a book who say that his father was Malcolm X. Other people who say that his father was someone else. And these threat assessments later became part of a 1,000 word threat assessment from Mars that was given to every U.S. president. And Mr. Bisciago has been contacted by a person who has worked subsequently in a White House, subsequent to the Nixon White House, in the Reagan, who has actually read that 10,000 word Mars threat assessment. This is the most deeply held secret, is that the U.S. has strategic bases on Mars because they're trying to colonize it. There was a phony, the threat assessment is being phonied up. Mr. Bisciago wrote a threat assessment in which he said he does not believe that the Martians were a threat, because what's happening is that the U.S. is now colonizing them, and it's natural that there would be some blowback from the Martians because we're invading their planet. Regina Dugan kind of took the militarist line, the Pentagon line, the defense contractor's line, and said, oh, they are a threat. And Barack Obama held his cards close to his chest, but presumably he would have gone along with the militarist threat because he's ended up as president of the United States. And so that's how the U.S. is attempting to acquire sovereignty over another planet, over the objections of the inhabitants of that planet, the Martian human civilization. Now, if you go to ProjectMars.net, that's the site of the Mars Anomaly Research Society, of which I serve as chairman, you'll see there over 60 papers of text and analysis written on the images of Martians, animals on the surface of Mars, structures and statues that are based on images from the Martian NASA rovers. And we can now, with the new generation of rovers, isolate all of these images. Now we have pictorial confirmation, apart from the whistleblowers. And the fourth whistleblower, I was Arthur Neumann, a former Department of Defense scientist who has gone to Mars on projects regarding on Department of Defense projects and met with Martians. And he went public at the 2009 Barcelona Exopolitics Conference. I was there present when he did it, and he did it in the company of Kerry Cassidy, head of Project Camelot. So we now have four independent whistleblowers, and we have, and in the law, we qualified them as reliable witnesses. And in the law, again, using the law of S, as you know, Trice, we go to the documentary evidence, and we qualified the NASA rover photographs of the surface of Mars and the images in there, and all of these now tend to confirm the remote viewing evidence that we initially set out in our book, Exopolitics. So that kind of brings us full circle. And my main methodology here is what I call the law of evidence. And that's a methodology which courts of law have used for generations in determining facts. And I use that because I'm an international lawyer, I'm a judge, and I've taught law at two universities, Yale and the University of Texas. And the law of evidence is a very practical methodology for sifting through and evaluating both witness testimony and documentary evidence like NASA rover photographs. That is how you determine facts. So thank you for letting me kind of lay out my case on this issue.
You're welcome, Alfred. A couple of questions here. Now, number one, of course, Alfred Bisaggio, like yourself, is an attorney in very good standing. So there would be no motivation for him to not speak from the heart with sincerity. But my question to you is, for example, have there been corroborative witnesses such as Major Ed Dames who actually agreed that he was there on Mars as well? Now, did I correctly remember in an article that Major Ed Dames was actually one of the instructors there? Has he come forward?
Yeah. Now, that's a key question. Mm-hmm. Because Ed Dames actually on 11/11, that fabled date, November 11, 2011, Andrew Bisaggio and Laura Eisenhower and Brett Stillings, who are three of the Mars experiencers. Laura Eisenhower is a corroborative witness in that there was an attempt to recruit her to be part of the Mars colony. In the middle of the, just prior to the program, I think just a few days prior to the program, my article had been published naming and outing Ed Dames. And Ed Dames, who at that time was Captain Ed Dames, and he actually taught that class, called in, and in a very flagrant and profanity-laced language denied that he was there. But he did so in an edible fashion that he started cursing the host, George Nuri, and had to be cut off the air by George Nuri, which very seldom happens. In fact, we were discussing it today, and the consensus of opinion is that Ed Dames' intervention, which was meant to sort of CYA, cover your rear end, was done in a very ineffective manner. he could have called in and said, I can neither confirm nor deny, because he would have violated his loyalty oath. But what we figure is this, is that over the years, Ed Dames has gotten in so deep with the Black Projects and probably has put out so much disinformation over coast to coast that they tasked him with calling in and trying to do a drive-by name-calling on Andrew Bisciago, who held his ground because Andrew is a trial lawyer and knew exactly how to demolish Ed on the stand, as it were. So Ed should have said, I can neither confirm nor deny, because if I did, it would violate my loyalty oaths. Instead, he undercut his credibility for those who follow this particular issue, and there are many who are following the Obama-Mars cover-up, and the life on Mars is now almost a separate specialty. We have a group on Mars, on Facebook, the Mars Anomaly Research Society, Revealing Mars, Marsgate. You know, you've heard of Watergate. Well, this is called Marsgate and Alternative 4. And so right now, what we figure is that if you look at the research, it's extraordinary, because the research shows that Barack Obama, rather than being at Columbia University between 1980 and 1983, was actually in Pasadena, California during those years, and was teleporting back and forth to Mars as part of the Mars visitation program, using the CIA teleport at 999 North Sepulveda Boulevard, which is right on kind of next to LAX airport. And he had enrolled at Columbia University as part of the CIA cover, because Obama is in fact a lifelong CIA operative. That's why Mr. Root, who was of the class of 1983, the valedictorian, who interviewed over 70 classmates in the political science area, no one can recall Obama ever being in class, and that there was ever a Barack Obama at Columbia University. And the reason is that there was never a Barack Obama at Columbia University. And what they've done is that they've manufactured what they call in the intelligence trade a legend that Barack Obama went to Columbia University, because they're covering for his having been in the Mars visitation program.
Well, those are interesting statements, but I've got to be transparent here, Alfred. This household is our definite President Obama supporters. So that's all I'm going to say. We're very strong President Obama supporters. We do consider him to be extremely intelligent and just a wonderful president of great character.
Look, politically, it's a free country. Before Watergate, President Nixon had a huge support. After Watergate, President Nixon had a very small support. I submit historically that we have a similar situation here.
Well, may I ask you a question? I'll tell you one thing, some thought-provoking discussion here. I will say that that proposed 1977 Carter White House extraterrestrial communication study would make one think. Tell me, you know, you were director of that, Alfred. That 1977 ET communication study was an actual project. What were the developments there?
Yeah, you know, this how actually I got to Stanford Research Institute as a futurist. As I mentioned earlier, in December of 1976, I was visiting the Bay Area, and on the recommendation of a colleague, went to visit Dr. Hal Puthoff and Russ Targ, and stated that I would like to, just to back up a bit, in the fall of 1976, President Jimmy Carter had campaigned openly on a UFO platform, in the sense that he had been asked by UFO activists at significant segments of the campaign whether or not he would open the secret UFO files, and he said, yes, if elected, I will open the UFO files and I will tackle the extraterrestrial issue. And so I followed that very, very closely. And at the time, at the end of 1975, Congressman Henry B. Gonzalez of Texas, Democrat, had invited me to go to Washington, D.C., and to meet with him to start a congressional investigation of the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, and Malcolm X. And so I worked with him on that, and that eventuated in the creation of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which was launched at the beginning of 1976. So I was active in that. And fast forward to December of 1976. By that time, Carter had won the 1976 presidential election against Gerald Ford, and we all of us in the UFO community now wanted to push him to honor his promise to open the UFO files. And I was based in New York, but I was in Washington often. And one of Carter's senior inside staff had been sent as a representative to Henry B. Gonzalez and to the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and I met him there. And he invited me to a dinner at which, this is during what they call the transition period, the period between which the election happens in November of 1976 and the inauguration happens in January 20th of 1977. So there we were in a house on Capitol Hill having dinner, and I was having member dinner with the Inner Circle. The Inner Circle called themselves JC and the 12 Apostles. Jimmy Carter, or Jesus Christ, and the 12 Apostles. This was before the Jimmy Carter cabinet was named and it was taken over by the Trilateralists. If you can remember, the chief of staff of Jimmy Carter said, look, if we name the cabinet and they're all Trilateralists, meaning they were all appointed by Rockefeller, you'll know something has happened. So right before that happened, the David Rockefeller apparatus had not taken over the Jimmy Carter presidency yet, and they were still, in this magical place, because don't forget that Jimmy Carter was a UFO contactee and had a UFO experience in 1969 in the company of the Lions Club of Mary, Georgia, which he reported in 1973 when he was running for governor. So there I was at this dinner, and I said to myself, you know, this is the best thing to do, is to work with the Jimmy Carter White House to get this, the whole UFO study open. So with that in mind, right after meeting with, having this dinner, I went back to New York, and I went to the West Coast, and I was in the Bay Area. And so I went up and made an appointment to meet with Dr. Hal Puthoff and Russ Targ, and I told them that I would like to come to Stanford Research Institute, and from Stanford Research Institute, work with the Carter White House as a partner to do the first scientific study on UFOs and extraterrestrials in the U.S. history, because all of the other studies have been done with the military as the prime investigative agencies. They said fine, and then I met with the futurists, and they brought me on with the understanding that that's what I would do. And as soon as I came on, this was after the inauguration of Carter, I made contact. I discovered who in the Carter White House was interested in the UFO issue. It was a young woman from the Denver. I made contact with her. I flew to Washington. I met with her. She was on the domestic policy staff. She said, yes, we're very, very interested. And I developed a project known as the Carter White House Extraterrestrial Communication Study. I brought on senior scientists. I received approval. All of this took a number of months, and we were going forward. And this was by October 1977, we were really ready to go. And it was at that point that the Department of Defense liaison, the Pentagon liaison to Stanford Research Institute, called a special meeting at SRI and flew here at the vice presidential level and asked me into that meeting, and the head of the futurists and a fellow futurist, Peter Schwartz, who was at that meeting also, and said that if this project went forward, even though it had White House approval, that the Pentagon would terminate all of its studies money with Stanford Research Institute, which were about $25 million, or a quarter of Stanford Research Institute's $100 million budget. Well, you can imagine what happened. That evening, the Carter White House extraterrestrial study was terminated. That was the harsh reality, that even though it received White House approval, the Pentagon was able to blackmail Stanford Research Institute into terminating that project. So it did not go forward. And immediately thereafter, I was targeted by military intelligence, and shortly after that left Stanford Research Institute because of extraordinary harassment by spooks and men in black types. So that's how that operated, and that's what happened to the 1976 Carter White House study.
Well, thank you very much for those details, Alfred. We will be returning in about 8 minutes. At that point, I'd very much like to discuss with you your new documentary.
Oh, great.
And also some of the interesting concepts in the Exopolitics book itself. You had a number of people who wrote interesting articles in a preface form for your book, and it's definitely a thought-provoking read. We'll be right back at 8, everyone. Thank you.
Good enough.
Issues. We go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
GeoScout's Dawn of Shades is featuring a new series this fall, one that is sure to catch your attention. It's the Music in America series, and it runs from November 15th through January 3rd, each Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific. We're going to start the journey off with Keith Sokola, a fresh Native American Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, and the journey will end with Buddy Cage from the new Riders of the Purple Sage. In between, we're going to talk with a country artist from Montana, a pop singer from New York City, a heavy metal artist fresh from Alaska, and even a busker in New Orleans, along with a whole lot more. It will be a unique experience for music fans as we find out who the artist really is and what it's really like to be in the industry. You won't want to miss this. You can also read more at www.exogenynetwork.com.
Your night with the Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hello, everyone. Trish Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Come join us each Friday evening at A Global Focus's new time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Come join the discussion.
UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to A Global Focus with guest Alfred Labermont Weber, JD, MED, futurist, and author of Exopolitics, Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe. Welcome back, everyone, to our second hour of discussion with Alfred Labermont Weber. Now, Alfred has several readers sending him IMs to the effect that they aren't quite sure where they can listen to this program. If they would just Google in UFOParanormalRadio.com. There are several listening venues. Again, UFOParanormalRadio.com. And please come join the discussion. And right now we have two excellent questions in the room. They are, Alfred, from one of our favorite researchers, Mark Eddy. He is creator of the website A Teacher and creator of the website Unusual Historic Places at marksancientwebsites.webs.com. Now, he very much... myself, I believe, appreciated your article about the I believe January 28th, 2011 sightings of the UFO over Jerusalem, and he's wondering, in sort of a religious vein, have you heard any new announcements from the Vatican? And secondly, he has a very interesting question as well about one of your past articles, and that's to the effect that he's wondering, Alfred, and this is per your January 25th, 2010 article. At the time of the Royal Society's 350th anniversary, if you believed that Newton and Wren, Christopher Wren, believed in E.T.
Okay, good. Yeah, sure. Just a couple of notes before I get there, and a note of clarification, because I always believe in respecting the local gods, and Trice, I voted for Barack Obama in 2008.
Oh, excellent.
And so, yeah, and so this is the result of research that I'm doing, and we're just reporting the facts, of the research that there appears to be a very large cover-up regarding the fact that Mr. Obama was trained to go to Mars and did go to Mars. And he was trained to go to Mars because he was a very talented 18-year-old. But there's a huge cover-up of that now, and within the last month, his White House has issued a formal statement in response to a White House petition that states that there's no objective proof that there are extraterrestrial life, whereas he has met other extraterrestrial life on Mars and was tasked with learning their language. So, there is a certain amount of cognitive dissonance there, and we in the Exopolitics Truth Movement feel that we are duty-bound to make this public. And so this is not a matter of politics. This is a matter of integrity in reporting, which are two different things. Second thing is that I'd like to get to these very excellent questions. The references are to two of my articles, January 28, 2011, January 2010. Those are my articles on examiner.com, and as you know, I have called for a public boycott of examiner.com. because of their participation in the cover-up of what I call the Obama Mars cover-up. And so people can find all of the Examiner articles in their process of changing them over now at exopolitics.com, which is a news portal for everything exopolitics. So I just wanted to mention that, I'll be a stickler, but You know, Trice, how attorneys are, right?
Well, that's true. You know, and I have my own beliefs as well. DC can be a very convoluted place. I really shouldn't mention my political preferences on air. It's supposed to be an objective program,
right.
So I probably shouldn't have mentioned my preference, but indeed it is.
It's fine because this places a conundrum with a very large portion of the progressive American populace and the progressive populace of the world, mm-hmm. who has supported this gentleman, and now we have objective evidence coming forward that there's an anomaly there. But let me get to the...
Can I ask you one more question on that particular subject?
Yeah.
On the Pythagoras conference that had been scheduled for this December,
yeah.
but that now has been canceled, but I'm sorry, rescheduled for next October.
Yeah.
Were you Andrew Bisaggio and Laura Eisenhower going to be presenting on this very matter?
Yes, and I have written to Sandy Sabatini. And said that I'd like to present at the 2012 conference, and I haven't heard back from her yet. I'm sure that she's very, very busy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, well, you know, and again, I just wanted to mention a very interesting article, and Mark, too, had read it as well, but on the 350th anniversary of the Royal Society in England, and I guess he really appreciated your train of thought, and how interesting if those luminaries, Newton and Wren, did believe that E.T. Was a factual matter. Now,
let me get to the two... questions.
Yes.
The first has to do with the Vatican. And let me say this, that what brought the whole issue of the there are two principal events, I think, that Vatican kind of forward on this issue. One is a conference on extraterrestrial life, and the other is statements by the Vatican, director of the Vatican Observatory, Father Funes, who is an Argentinian astronomer who's also a Jesuit. Now, and he sort of started this whole ball rolling with a statement about 2 years ago saying, the extraterrestrials are brothers and you can believe in extraterrestrials and still be a good Catholic. Kind of opening the way from a doctrinal point of view to, from the fundamentalist point of view where extraterrestrials are the devil. I mean, that's what some of the fundamentalist sects, notably in North America, still hold. I was a bit disappointed to learn that in a recent public statement, Father Funes really backed off from the sort of universal scope of his original and really backed off and seemed to say that there's no objective evidence that extraterrestrial life exists, whereas there's enormous evidence that extraterrestrial life exists. In fact, Bishop McIntyre reportedly was dispatched from the 1954 meeting between President Dwight Eisenhower and extraterrestrials, where he was the Archbishop of Los Angeles and was allowed to be there as an observer, and then he flew directly to the Vatican. And in fact, the U.S. Department of Defense intercepted his plane and before it left the United States on the way to the Vatican. It says, remember what you saw. This was classified. You can't talk about it. But he said, yeah, that's right. And he probably yesed them. But he went directly to the Vatican and reported to the Pope about the meetings that Eisenhower had had with the human ETs. So the Vatican has been a point of contact with extraterrestrials, and there are a number of very well-witnessed episodes in this regard, not only with Eisenhower, but has been an initial point of contact with the Martians, who would organize, who have organized, reported journeys to Mars that took place under the informal auspices of the Vatican from a point of departure in the Brazilian Amazon. Now, this is back in the 20s and 30s, where they would take groups of distinguished humans in Martian craft to Mars. And we know now, we have eyewitnesses of Martian craft. Andrew Bishago reports that in 1970, at a U.S. defense base on the East Coast, in the company of his father, who was a CIA contractor, with three Martian astronauts who had arrived in a Martian craft, who were in a defense technical liaison visit with their counterparts in the U.S. Department of Defense. So the U.S. government has had a strategic liaison with the Martian human civilization for a long time. So given this very well witnessed and documented history, long-standing history of the Vatican having human extraterrestrial liaison programs, I find it troubling, use the word transparency, I find it troubling that the Vatican is still engaging through Father Funes in these modified, limited hangouts with these laborious conferences and, you know, with Father Funes' statements where he comes out and then he backs off and says, well, maybe there's some microbes on Mars. That's all very misleading, and it's still part of the cover-up. So I still think that we have a situation where I can pick this up later when we talk about the film and about Adam's calendar in South Africa, that we're still living under the heritage of the Anunnaki Illuminati hierarchical rulership of this planet.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And can I just make a comment here? I know we're about to turn. Thank you so much for that intriguing answer. Now, you mentioned in your documentary, it sounds very interesting, entitled Awakening Adam's Calendar. The film will be released in 2012. Now, Alfred, you believe a race of Anunnaki ETs established themselves first in the deep Abzu region of South Africa. They established a type of machine for the teleporting of gold to their planet. Now, I'm jumping in here, Alfred, because one of the many individuals who recommended your book, and that would be Robert O'Dean, retired Sergeant Major in the Air Force, and he's also an intelligence analyst, or was, at his presentations at times will mention the Anunnaki, but without a really negative focus. Now, you do contend that the Anunnaki were violating human rights.
Yes. If you go back to take the grand historical perspective. And if you go back to how Homo sapiens originated and what the intervention of the Anunnaki were, and the best information or the working hypothesis that we've been able to develop is that Homo sapiens, which we are, developed as a consortium project of the upper dimensional ethical civilizations of our sector of the galaxy. People like the Pleiadians, the Alpha Centaurians, and the Sirians, who are involved in our affairs and who are part of the governance, galactic governance of our galaxy through galactic federations and galactic councils. And they embarked upon a project to develop a 12-strand DNA, light being in the third dimension. And that's a very, very fancy sort of a being that they developed as Homo sapiens. And at that time, one of the three major predators on predator ET races on Homo sapiens, namely the Anunnaki ET. The Anunnaki ET originate on what we call Planet X, which is an unascended planet from an ascended star system in the Sirius B star system. So that they sort of have been marooned in the third dimension and were caught up in the gravity of our sun, Sol, and would come into our planet once every 3,600 years. And they have been coming into our planet since about 500,000 years ago. And treating it as sort of a an R&R and resource place. That is, they can come, they can take our resources like the gold, which they then take back to their planet to construct all sorts of shields to protect them because they are no longer inside a solar system. So they're a very exploitative, hierarchically oriented, service to self species, this came into collision. There's a thing called the law of non-intervention, which is not a strictly enforced law, but it's a law that governs life-bearing planets. And that is where certain planets will be under the jurisdiction of galactic governance councils that are charged with the husbandry of that planet, that is, with life implantation. And you can go and you can follow the 260 million year cycles and the 60 million year cycles and the 12,920 year cycles on planets like ours. And you can see that life appears suddenly. Species appear suddenly and species disappear suddenly. And the reason for that is that the process of creation is highly decentralized. And while there is micro, what we can call microevolution, once a species is implanted on a planet, the species themselves are brought to planets by advanced extraterrestrial or interdimensional races that are so advanced that they're given the task of husbanding planets and creating races on them. And that's how the Homo sapiens came about. Well, in the midst of this, the Anunnaki, who were exploiting our planet for gold, came upon the Homo sapiens project. And rather than respect the law of non-interference, they had the advanced science that one can change DNA and devolve DNA through sound. And they devolved our DNA from 12 strand down to 2 strand, which is where we are now. And what Adam's calendar represents, I and a group of people, Lloyd Pye, Laura Eisenhower, a number of international and South African speakers, spoke at the UFO Science and Consciousness Conference in Johannesburg from November 26th to 27th, 2011, and then we went to Adam's calendar. And if you look under from the sky, it extends from South Africa all the way up to almost its northern and western borders. And it's a site that was created 280,000 years ago when the Anunnakis first landed there. And Zechariah Sitchin translated the Sumerian tablets that talk about Enki, the leader of the Anunnaki who landed. And this is exactly where they landed. So we were able to go back physically, as Laura Eisenhower said, to the scene of the crime. We saw where the Anunnaki land. We saw this vast network stretching out hundreds of miles of these stone circles. And each of the stone circles would become sort of a free energy machine that they would use in concert with the gold mines to teleport the gold down to the central place at Adam's calendar, which is kind of at the center of all of this, and then which was a teleportation machine to teleport the gold either up into their waiting Anunnaki spaceship or directly to their planet, probably into their spaceship. And at the same time, the Anunnaki were targeting the fledgling human race and devolving our DNA back to 2-strand, so we would be extremely limited in conscious and back and not multidimensional beings. We're 2-strand now, and we're engaged in war, disease, crime, and poverty. And so what you realize is that this cycle has been going on for 280,000 years, and it hasn't been broken. And we still have the Anunnaki planetary rulers. Right now, the British Crown, Queen Elizabeth, is the current version of the Anunnaki planetary ruler, who traces her bloodline back to the Anunnakis. And she's grooming her grandson, Prince William, to be the next Anunnaki ruler. And they own most of the resources of the planet and a great deal of the landmass. So we're back. We're in the same situation that we've been in for 280,000 years, where we're just race slaves. And I think that this is some of the impulse that was behind the Occupy movement. But nobody has really begun to put all these pieces together. So from an exopolitical standpoint and a communication standpoint. So that's what we're doing with this film, which is called Awakening Adam's Calendar.
Well, those are definitely new thoughts. They're unusual thoughts. But now, let me ask you a question, Alfred. You've written some articles, too, that were rather thought-provoking, analyzing, reviewing the work of Ms. Corey, author of the book No More Secrets, No More Lies. Will she be a guest in that documentary, I believe? She also proposes that 12-strand DNA theory. And also, I've got to say this here, Alfred. I know people do consider Zachariah, the Russian author, Zachariah Sitchin, to be brilliant, but I know I find the work of Dr. Michael Heiser more compelling as to his translations of the text. But interesting thoughts, and also I think the room here would be very intrigued by researcher Corey's concept that there were four different seed groups or seeded groups in our ancient history. That's very intriguing.
Yeah, yeah. One of the lecturers who spoke at the UFO Science and Consciousness Conference in South Africa is William Brown, who's a geneticist at the University of Hawaii. And he gave a genetic justification and showed that, that in fact our blueprint is the 12th strand, and that even with the 2 strand, we have a 3rd strand, which is a light-based strand, such that from a scientific genetic perspective, he showed that in our genome, we are 12-strand DNA dormant now. And this is from a genetic standpoint. He's a brilliant geneticist who is integrating both the standard academic genetics as well as the multidimensional genetics.
That non-coding sequences?
Yeah, so that he corroborates what persons like Patricia Corey, who in her books, she's been given this information through dimensional communication. Now, we have scientific confirmation of this.
Because I was going to ask Alfred, please pardon my interruption here. Did Patricia Corey's research findings come from channeling or from remote viewing or what?
Yeah, she is given information dimensionally, mm-hmm. and that is the content of her books. And now we are able to confirm that content through the scientific presentations of William Brown, this geneticist who teaches at the University of Hawaii.
Well, sounds like an interesting conference there in South Africa. Now,
yeah.
Alfred, if we could turn to your treatise there on exopolitics, politics, government, and law in the universe.
Sure.
And even before we do that, just a real quick question. Alfred, have you ever read the Declaration of Human Sovereignty? It's a great document posted at the humansovereignty.org website. It was produced by the Human Sovereignty Work Group. I believe there were attorneys who wrote that, related to Marshall V. and Summers and his Greater Community Group. Have you ever heard that Declaration of Human Sovereignty?
I have read the Marshall Summers. In fact, it was at the first academic conference where I first taught. I was a keynote speaker at the University of Montana conference in the year 2000, and it was at that conference in the address surfacing exopolitics, and that's the first venue in which exopolitics was publicly discussed in an academic context. And the Marshall people had a booth there, and they approached me and they gave me all of their literature. And I'm just Googling. It says, "We the people of Earth extend greetings to the greater community." And fundamental rights, the right of sovereignty, the right of planetary sanctuary, the right of sanctity, the right of occupation, the right of peace and navigation. The way that we translate this, for example, at the Mars Anomaly Research Society, mm-hmm. is that we are now in the process of creating a Mars Protection Treaty, which will be a treaty between the Martian human civilization and the earthly human civilization, probably through the agency of all the nations of the United Nations, which is intended to protect the Martian, the fragile Martian and the fragile Martian ecology, and which is intended to protect Mars from colonization and occupation by Earth, which is occurring now at two levels. Number one, covertly, by the program of colonization that the U.S. government is carrying out with its facilities on Mars, which independent researchers, including David Wilcock, now number at 500,000 people. Secondly, at a second level, we have a number of human space agencies, the Russian Space Agency, the European Space Agency, the Japanese Space Agency, the Chinese Space Agency, the U.S. Space Agency, are all preparing missions to Mars. And yet, none of these missions, all of these are by the surface space agencies that are not being briefed by the secret space agencies that are already on Mars, that know how fragile the Martian ecology is, know that there is an underground Martian civilization of about 1 million Martians, and know that there are about 500,000 Americans there. So we need a interplanetary legal regime that will govern all of this. So we're covered with a treaty that we're going to bring to the United Nations and to the Martians. We haven't figured out how we're going to do that yet, but I'm sure it can be done so that this treaty can be signed. And what we've discovered through artifacts on Mars, including the sarcophagus of a king, which are in the Egyptian fashion, is that prior to the solar system catastrophe of 9500 BC, 11,500 years ago, in which a fragment of the Vela supernova came into the solar system and essentially blew away a large part of the Martian atmosphere and made an oblong planet and crashed into Earth partially and destroyed the great maritime civilization of Earth that Plato called Atlantis. Prior to that, we had a Martian Earth interplanetary society under the rulership of the Egyptian pharaohs, who were bloodline descendants of the Anunnaki planetary rulers.
Well, those thoughts are very intriguing. They're unusual. And you know, Alfred, your exopolitics book really presents some very new thoughts. For example, tonight your discussion of the Anunnaki as well reminds me of your reference to things that you believe are necessarily linked with exopolitics, that being exoarchaeology, exobiology, and exopolitics itself. And that certainly seems to be the case there. As far as the as introducing a new legal system or social system, on another world. What really intrigued me was the fact that you think that our present governmental system on Earth reflects Earth's quarantine status, but also represents holographically fragments of the universal ideal. Kind of an unusual thought.
Yes, yes. You know, about a year and a half ago, I was approached by Oxford University Press, which is the division of Oxford University, who asked me to write a book on extraterrestrial civilizations and the law. And when I was approaching that task, I realized that, first of all, I had to write a typology of extraterrestrial civilizations. And that was something that had never been done before, because there are some existing typologies, but they're inadequate. For example, the Kardashev typology, which has been popularized by Dr. Michio Kaku, which says that there are four types of planets, a zero-type civilization, a one-type, a two-type, a three-type, and those are differentiated by how they use energy. We're a zero type in the sense that we are use only the energy of the planet, like fossil fuels, and we hope we can get to a one type, which uses the energy of its solar system before we destroy ourselves. But I realized in writing this, because that's not how civilizations think of themselves and describe themselves. The way that extraterrestrial and intelligent civilizations think of themselves is as, quote, dimension-based. And by dimensions, we mean a discrete boundary of quantum energy frequencies within which consciousness can exist according to certain boundaries. Right now, we live in the dimension of time-space, known as the third dimension. And when you start reading extraterrestrial transcripts, they say, oh, I'm a Pleiadian from the fifth dimension, or I'm an Arcturian from the sixth dimension. And the boundaries of the fifth dimension and the sixth dimension are very different from the third. In the fifth and sixth dimension, you'll find that instead of time being sort of an organizing principle, light and love, with capital L's, will be organizing principles. It's very difficult for us to imagine that. So sorts of considerations that one has to deal with when attempting to apply a third dimension legal system to the rest of the multiverse. How could we, in a third-dimensional court, for example, acquire jurisdiction over a galactic federation that is in the ninth dimension? You can't get there from here.
Well, those are very intriguing concepts, and you know, you already answered my question that came to mind. When you were giving a description why both governmental systems and humans themselves exist both in spiritual and material realities.
Yes. That is really the subject of my next book, which is the first book that I've written in 10 years. It's called Dimensions, the Ecology of the Multiverse. What we realize is that the dimension of the human afterlife is as much a component of the multiverse as the, quote, created time-space matrix within which we live. One of DARPA's scientific findings from their Project Pegasus time-space program is that the time-space matrix, or the time-space hologram within which we live, is an artificial environment that was created by a higher intelligence. Now, that's an extraordinary finding.
Indeed. Wow, what an interesting 2 hours, Alfred. I know everyone found your concepts very intriguing, and again, that Exopolitics, Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe, the treatise is a very interesting read. I definitely will be purchasing your copy of Dimensions, the Dimensional Ecology of the Multiverse. And I wish you a wonderful holiday season, you and your family. Now, where will you be next presenting? Where will you be next presenting, Alfred?
Yes, I have a 2012 schedule coming up. We'll be putting it up shortly at exopolitics.com, and our first date will be in January 2012, in which Andrew Bishagla and I will be doing a special two-day weekend on life on Mars. And Andy will be taking the perspective of the Mars experiencer who will be there. I'm taking the perspective of the exopolitical and the kind of the space attorney presenting the treaty and where we need to go as a society to really come together with the Martians in one, you know, to make ourselves once again an interplanetary society, and to bring all of this to public awareness, and also to make people know that the man occupying the White House has been to Mars. Man.
Well, it has been an interesting evening. Now, Alfred, again, great holiday season to you and your family.
Thank you.
We thank our listeners. Thank you for spending time with us this evening. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone. Good night, all. Thanks, everyone, for listening to this evening's program with guest Alfred Labermont Weber. We appreciate your time this evening and wish you a great weekend.